Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, usairishradio.com, and I'm delighted to welcome a friend of mine. He was much younger when I met him, and we won't talk about what age I might have been either then or now, but Larry Kerwin, you're very welcome indeed.
Ah, Adrian, it's great to be on with you again. Two survivors.
Yeah. At the stage where you're known as a survivor, you know, not the worst thing in the world, especially
no.
for me, anyway. I'd like to have our listeners know a little bit about you. And you were born in Wexford in Ireland, and you've been in New York for how many years, give or take?
I came over in the 70s as a student, and then I went back for a little while, and I came back in 72, and I've been here pretty much. I was illegal for the first 3 years. I couldn't leave.
Right.
And by the time I went back, I didn't fit in anymore. I love New York so much, you know, the usual.
Yeah, well, so far we're on the same page there. But anyway, you were leader of Black 47 for, a quarter of a century, for 25 years, you know, and how would you describe, you know, the band, the music, and how you turned not only New York, but the United States upside down with a, not just a type of music, but music that had, you know, a political tone, and it was a rock band. And if anybody had asked me at the time, and nobody did, how would this go over? I would say I don't know, but you made it a success beyond all others with 16 albums and about 2,500 gigs, we'll take it up from there, because I don't know how many musicians, bands can claim. And their claim to fame would be to be on, you know, Leno and Letterman and Conan O'Brien and Fallon. As a matter of fact, every major U.S. TV show. How did that come about?
Well, we were original right from the start. I formed a band with Chris Byrne. Chris Byrne was my partner
indeed.
In the band. He was a New York City detective at the time. Mm. So here you had a guy who was a playwright who had played music before, but I was out of the music business. And I met Chris in Patty Riley's one night, and it turned out that his band at the time, Beyond the Pale, was breaking up. So he had some gigs to do, and we got talking, and I said, I'll do them with you. And we decided to call the band Black 47, which was something that my grandfather used to use all the time. And we intended the band to be political right from the start, and not just in Irish politics, but in politics in general. And so we went up to the Bronx to do those gigs, and everybody hated us. It was just unreal. We weren't that good either, of course, at the time, because we didn't really have time to practice much. And we were right from the start, we decided we were going to do original music. And, you know, in the Bronx in those days, you know, it was four sets a night, and people came to hear songs that they recognized. And our thing was, no, this is original. And so we got fired from most places, but we kept persevering. And after about 4 or 5 months, we started to build a following. And that following really took off when we went to Patty Riley's. And so people from all the boroughs would come into Riley's. We had 25 people who liked us from each different borough. And then in Riley's, we had a big scene. And we started getting write-ups in the papers because we had lines around the block trying to get in. You know, that kind of
rumor
thing.
Has it, of course, that Steve Duggan, well known to us, the manager at large, and some say he owned the place, and we leave that one alone. He probably did, but the rumor was that Steve was going out selling tickets for the place, and he'd go down the whole line, and then people would be lucky if they got in for the last half an hour. But anyway, that's only a rumor, and you didn't hear it from me. Okay, so we'll take it from there.
Well, Steve was a good part in promoting the band, because Steve was booking Paddy Riley and some other bands in the Irish festivals. So
right.
That was one of the things that helped us around the country, because the Irish festivals up to then had been a different type of thing. So all of a sudden we were on MTV, and we had a kind of a hit single with Funky Cayley. So Steve was booking us in places around the country, and we were bringing a new audience into the festivals too, and turning them more into rock festivals rather than traditional music. And everyone was doing good business, and everybody was happy with it. So Steve had a good part to do with the band.
I remember,
and the songs too were important. You know,
absolutely. I remember Steve, though, at the time, the Rockaway Irish Festival down 108th Street was in full swing, primarily under the direction of Sheila Hines.
Yes,
who would then go on and go down and present festivals down in Florida and
Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Both of them.
But I was, I don't know exactly what my title would have been, but I would say that I was, playing second fiddle to the, you know, to the Steve Duggans of this town here. And Steve called me in, he says, "You have to put this band on." I said, "What band?" He says, "Black 47. And I said, "Sure." And then you played Rockaway, and I could not believe, and neither could any of us, that in, you know, this generally conservative Irish Catholic place, that you, were so extremely well received. Because it was new, it was rock. But also, your original music, it was incredible. And you kept that going for the next 25 years.
Well, it was an unusual lineup, and it happened organically. First of all, it was Chris and myself.
Yeah.
Chris was playing Ilum pipes, and I was playing electric guitar and programming a drum machine. And then Fred Parcells, who was a kind of a genius on the trombone, came from a wild Latin jazz background. He and I used to play in improv bands down in Lower Manhattan. So he thought it was an improv band, and he just showed up with his trombone one night, didn't even say hello to Chris, and started playing. So then we were three, and then Jeff Blythe from the band Dexys Midnight Runners. I knew his wife, and I met his wife on the street one day, and she said, "You know, Jeff's gone crazy. Dexys broken up, and he's over here with me." And I said, "Well, send him down to the gig." And Jeff came in, and he said to me, "What should I play?" And I said, "Well, you know, just get in there, man, and go for it." And of course, Jeff was a real good improver too. And then Thomas Hamlin, my old drummer from the rock band days, he joined, and then we had different bass players down the years. So everybody kind of did their own thing within the band, and I would kind of arrange it, but you know, everyone was free to take it away whatever way they wanted to. So there was every gig was different, and we never did the same set in 2,500 gigs.
Yeah.
That was
amazing. Yeah,
because yeah, I'd always change it in the middle. I used to write out a set before we'd go on stage in case I'd, wasn't able to carry on or something.
Yeah.
Well, I would change it after about three or four songs because I would gauge it. What's the audience? What's going on with the audience? Not just to please them, but to shake them up sometimes. And
right. Well, you did that. Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely shook them up.
You know, the nice cop, not so nice cop. Of the two of you, I think that Chris might have been, considered the nice cop. You were throwing stuff out there, and you wouldn't know whether to get closer to you or run away. But it was original, and you managed to cut a furrow. I can say that very few, bands or groups along the way had as much success as Black 47. 25 years. That's kind of a record for, for bands anywhere. But when did you decide, or you, Chris, decide that hitting the road, traveling, with the band and being, throughout the United States and for that matter, throughout, there and beyond, that had now become taxing. Was it a conscious decision to say, listen, we're doing one more year and that's it, then we're getting out?
No, it was very different. Well, Chris actually left to form another band, Patty Ogogo, and Shanaki, in 2000, right before 2001, or close to that. And so we got Joseph Mulvanerty into play, and Joseph came from a more jazzy kind of background, so we started to go a little more in that direction, but we were still political and everything. But what happened was in 2013, at the September 2013, at the South Buffalo Festival, we were on stage, and I remember thinking, man, the band sounds as good as I've ever heard it. You know, and we had the place, it was a huge festival, and the place was up rocking and everything. And it struck me, because I was always a boxing fan, this is the time to quit. Quit when you're ahead, when you're still doing all the things you can do. So on the way back from Buffalo, I was thinking about this, and for the next month or so, it wouldn't leave my mind. And then finally, I called up all the guys, and I said, what we should do is let's give it a full other year. We'll do a whole new album, and we'll go back and we'll play in every place we played around the country and just go out with a bang. And we did that, and then ended up in B.B. King's on 42nd Street on November 14th. That was 2014. So it was planned out to be exactly 25 years after our first gig. And it worked,
Amazing, yeah. A great way, and as I say, that would be foreign to some of us who fancied ourselves as musicians in terms of knowing when to get out. We were waiting for the hearse to show up.
The other thing was to give everybody that year to decide what they wanted to do.
Right.
So it wouldn't be just pulling the carpet under anyone.
Yeah.
As it turned out, we were having such a great time traveling around and everything. I don't think anybody gave it much thought.
Let me ask you, and I think we probably have to double back here, to your first passion and your writing of novels. Walk us through that one. Does that bring it back to Wexford?
Yeah, I was actually more into playwriting right from the start, but it became hard sometimes to do, I was still writing the plays, but to follow through with them, because we always played weekends, Thursday, Friday, Saturday,
right.
And that would be the time when you would do workshops with plays.
Sure.
So I was finding that, you know, although I've written, I think, 19 plays and musicals at this point, there were times I couldn't follow through. But what I could do was novels, because the novel writing is a solitary business. And so I started doing novels, I think around, my mother had just died, and so that's 2000. Yeah, around 2000 I started writing novels. And I found that, you know, I could always write songs, I could always write plays, and then it was a whole learning process. How do you write a novel? But that I could find out what's the idea about, and then I could choose, is it going to be a song, a play, or a novel? And they all took different skills, but it all comes from the old Irish thing of how do you tell a story?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can go into any bar or any pub in Ireland, and you can listen to a guy at the bar, and he can tell a story that, you know, like no one's business. And it all comes from character. You know,
mm-hmm.
An Irish person is able to create characters straight away, and then it's a matter of putting them in situations, usually under some kind of stress, I find. And because that's when people make mistakes, and out of mistakes you find,
right,
you know, you find good stories. So it's part of it is the old Irish thing, and maybe the Wexford thing too. You know?
Yeah. Now, writing novels, no trouble to you. Of the novels that you have written and have garnered a lot of attention, Liverpool Fantasy, was that the first novel you tackled?
Yes, that was the first novel. And I did it because the play Liverpool Fantasy got done in a lot of places around the U.S. and the U.K. and Ireland. And then I got really busy with the band, and I couldn't promote it as a play. So I thought, let me put this in the form of a novel, because I had lived with the play so long. There were other extraneous characters that I wanted to bring in and to show the relationship between John Lennon and Paul McCartney in particular.
Right.
How to expand that and deal with it in the way I knew that, you know, Liverpool Fantasy might have been about the Beatles, but it was really about what's it like to be in a band. And you know yourself that when you've been in a band with certain people, you're always close to them, you know. You never lose the closeness. You might not play with them in 30 years, but you do have that relationship and that link still with them. So that's what Liverpool Fantasy was really about. The second one was about the Bronx, about the whole scene, the Irish scene.
Rockin' the Bronx.
Rockin' the Bronx. Yeah. Even when I was up there, and I love the Bronx, when I was up there, I knew somebody should be writing about this, because this scene won't last forever. And so I was taking mental notes the whole time, even though I was part of the scene and everything. I was trying to see it from both inside and from outside. What's it like to come from somewhere in Ireland, you know, especially a rural place, and all of a sudden you're thrown into the Bronx? It's a huge jump psychically and, you know, financially, everything. And it made for a great story. And I'm so glad I wrote Rock in the Bronx, because I had no idea that that whole area around Bainbridge and 204 was going to disappear. You know, I thought that would last for a long, long time. And I remember going back to it with Black 47, and we played the last gig up there on Bainbridge. I forget which bar it was now, but It was the last one. I remember standing outside it after and thinking, oh my God, this place is gone from the Irish people, you know?
Yeah.
And years later, I'd come up and there was a documentary being done on the band, and we shot part of it on Bainbridge in 204. And I had trouble actually finding the storefront.
Yeah, wow.
Where that I'd known so well. And, yeah. You know, so I was glad I got that one down. You know?
That was excellent. Green Suede Shoes, of course. And history of Irish music, was that a reflection on, say, your 25 years rather than just taking Irish music from Adam and Eve the time long ago? What was...
Well, Well, I wrote Green Suede Shoes as a memoir of growing up in Ireland and coming here and all the different changes I saw. With a history of Irish music, I wrote that when, in that year that I described to you, when we went out on the road to do our last year's gigs, I thought, let me write something because I'm going to be going out of this world soon, this world of live music, or, you know, not totally out of it, but, you know, I'm going to be going out of the intensity of it because there would be no more Black 47. So that was the idea in the book first, to tell what it was like being in a band like Black 47, because a lot of people, they love music and everything, and they, but they don't really know what goes on. But as I began the book, I realized that, you know, even for me to tell that story, I have to go back to my first listening to music in Wexford and listen to the local bands and listen to people like Sean O'Rita and the Dubliners and all that. So I had to give the story of the folk revival and then all the different bands that I saw and then coming over here. And then, you know, I got to meet so many well-known musicians and everything, like people even like Johnny Cash, you know?
Yeah.
Because I knew his daughter, Roseanne, well. And I thought, you know, I should write this down because I can let people know what it's like to be on the inside and what people are really like, you know? People like Joe Strummer from The Clash was a great friend, and then I worked closely with Rick Ocasek from The Cars, and he produced Fire of Freedom. So I got a look at how the music business works and how, you know, how talented some people are, and yet how fragile they are too. You know, there's a fragility to musicians that a lot of people don't see. You know, the years on the road, they, if you're not looking after yourself, it's dangerous out there. I have so many friends who are dead from being on the road. And, and one of the ways I managed to stay alive, because there's a lot of temptations out there, is that I had this real drive to write. So I couldn't get too drunk at night because I wanted to go back to the room and write a few sentences before I went to bed, and I wanted to wake up in the morning and, you know, while the band is still sleeping, I can write then too. So I think it all
worked
melded
out
into each other. Yeah.
You know, collaborating with, you know, Thomas Keneally of Schindler's List on Musical Transport, for which he wrote music and lyrics. Now, was that you or he, and what was the collaboration?
Tom came to me in Paddy Riley's one night. His a relation by marriage, Nina Keneally, was a mutual friend, and Tom came to me and he said, listen, I have this story. It's about my wife's great-grandmother. She was picked up in 1840 for selling or for stealing a loaf of bread, and she was transported to Australia. And
Van
I want to write,
Land, yeah,
yeah, Van Diemen's Land, and I want to put that into a musical. And she said, "I know you've done a lot for Irish American styles. Can you do something that would be similar for Irish Australia?" And you know, Tom was such a great character, so he went back to Australia, and I said, "Well, send me what you have," you know.
Yeah.
And Tom sent me an outline of what he had. It would all take part on this ship called the Whisper, which was the name of the ship that took his wife's great-grandmother from Cork Harbor to Sydney, actually, they went to. Mm. And that was great because it was going to be set on board a ship, so it was ideal for stage. And then Tom, being a novelist, he would write really long speeches for people, and they were beautiful, but they were more, you know, suitable for novels. If you did the same yeah. thing on stage, it would, you know, it would just take too long. So what I used to do is I would turn those speeches into songs, and then being a playwright, I helped, you know, sort certain things out. So it was Tom's story, and and I kind of helped him with it. I learned a lot. We went out to Australia and did it, and then we did it at the Irish Rep.
Yes.
With Tony and directing, and it was a great experience. I got to see Australia and through Tom's eyes, and then go out there and work on it. So it's still an ongoing thing between us, because when I was in out in Berkeley with Paradise Square, a new musical that is going to Broadway, I had a lot of off time, and I took it up again and took up Transport again with Tom's permission and worked on it. So there's a new kind of a new script to it that we're going to start shopping around again. So
right, yeah.
The theater always goes on. You know,
so. Yes, and of course, we're assuming and hoping, of course, that by March 22nd of next year, that is absolutely great and something to look forward to. Now, you're currently adapting The Informer, by Liam O'Flaherty for stage. That's, I wouldn't say it's a tricky one, but how do you take a play like that, a very complex play, and adapt, you know, it to something, you know, that will, you know, first of all, not run afoul of the original? How does that work? Is it like editing? Is it like adding to the original? How does that work?
I think it's more reimagining,
okay.
Because Liam O'Flaherty wrote this great book back in 1923.
You're right.
I think it's when he first started to write it. And, you know, things were dangerous in Ireland at that time. The Civil War was just coming to an end. People were getting assassinated and everything. So there are certain things he didn't say also in the book. He never mentions the Civil War, probably because, you know, sort of good chance of, you know, getting hit himself because of it. And Sean O'Casey didn't really deal that thoroughly, I thought, with the Civil War either, although he did deal with it. So I'd always felt like, let me do something about the Civil War. And then I got a call from Bobby Moresco, who's he got an Academy Award for the movie Crash, and he was an old friend. And he said, you know, would you think of working on The Informer and putting it into a play that would work nowadays?
Yeah.
So that was part of it, because it was old at this point, and I watched the movie then, the John Ford movie, which I grew up with. My grandfather took me to it, I think, three different times with Victor McLaughlin, because it was his favorite movie. But then when I went to watch it again, it seemed kind of dated. So it was more a matter of making the characters just a bit more modern, and also in expanding the women characters in it.
Yeah.
Because O'Flaherty was no great feminist, and also O'Flaherty may be one of the few Irish writers who doesn't have a sense of humor. I had to bring in a kind of a black humor into it. But basically what you're trying to do is keep the whole spirit of what he set out to do, and yet maybe put some different clothes on it, you know, some different flesh on it. But
Now, again, by now I'm sure listeners would know without a doubt that in spite of yourself, you are indeed a political activist. And you're, most people will want to know, is that the guy from the Irish Echo, the columnist that you're speaking with? And yes, it is. Now, you've been a columnist with the Irish Echo newspaper for God knows how long.
I think it's about 12 years, huh? Something like that. Yeah.
And then, in case that wasn't enough, you're a celebrity host of Celtic Crush on Sirius XM satellite radio, and I believe that it was probably accidental, or you never know, being a friend of Malachy McCourt, perhaps as a mutual friend, you probably did it on purpose. You run against my programs, you know, and have done so, but, you know, I only bring it up because, you know, from our background, you know, our tradition has said anyway that we forget everything as we get older except our grievances. So, you know, but tell us about that, because it's Celtic Crush, and of the programs that I've heard, and you're doing that for, again, what, about 15 years?
15 years, yeah.
Yeah. You do your own thing. You present and you give your own read on songs and on music. And that's, some might say, well, that's, you know, that's a bit dangerous, particularly as we know in the music business, you know, try telling people that what the origin of Daddy Boy is or something else like that, and you get a backlash and say, my God, leave it alone. That's an Irish song, and don't start questioning that, or whether the real Eddie Moore came to. There is an area there where which either you ignore or you, you know, you say, here, I'm putting my version out.
Well, how it came about was I was up at SiriusXM doing an interview myself. I think it was for the Green Suede Shoes memoir and the album that came out with it. And I was doing it with a lady called Meg Griffin, who was a big DJ host, still is on SiriusXM. And, you know, she was an old friend, and afterwards we were out in the corridor, and being old friends, we were, you know, going through, you know, crazy things that happened to us, and we were laughing our heads off, and I didn't even see him, but one of the heads of the station was walking by at the time, and he heard I had an accent, and he called Meg over and said, you know, we are looking for someone to do a Celtic show. Can this guy talk? And she said, you know, put a couple of drinks in him, you'll never shut him up. And so they didn't know what a Celtic show was. Meg kind of had an idea, and she took me into the studio and taught me how to run the controls. And it was really good that she was with me, because we were close friends, and she'd say, well, what do you want to do? And I taught the old FM radio way of playing three songs at a time, three in a row, and then talking about them after. That seemed to be the most pop, or the easiest way of doing it for me. So I just started talking about the songs, and quite a number of them I knew the people, so I was able to give background into the people. Never anything personal about them, or, you know, what they were up to on the road or anything like that, but to deal really with the music. And then over the years, it kind of expanded to what it is now. And basically, the way I treat it is like a gig. I don't really prepare much, because I found that was easier. If I go in and I improv, I can do the whole thing, and it doesn't take that much preparation. You know, I program the songs I'm going to play. So as I'm programming them, I have kind of an idea what I might say about this particular song or the particular artist. And then on the day of the show, I just go in and go for it. And and it works, you know. And I didn't want to spend that much time on it, because I had so many other things to do, and I found that I could do a good show. Yeah, sometimes you fall on your face when you're improvising, but, you know, people got used to it. He's made a mistake, or he's whatever, you know, he's got to get himself out of this one, you know.
But I'm rather familiar with that aspect of it. I was actually hoping that you wouldn't bring it up. But anyway, there you go. As you, for five solid years, you were president of the Irish American Writers and Artists. And since I was never invited to any of your gigs or events, you know, I would say, no, Anya Sheridan here is telling me I was? Okay. Did I show up?
You were at a number of events.
All right. I was actually indirectly taking a swipe at Malachy McCourt there, because he's the one that generally has, you know, does a gig, and then he tells you about it afterwards. He says, I was surprised I didn't see you there. But anyway, listen, let's give the details on the book. It's Rockaway Blue. And you're not dealing with muck here, because, of course, it was, and the publisher is Cornell University Press.
Yep.
And just, it's available on Amazon. And God knows, friends, you can get it Canada, UK, Europe, New Zealand, all places. But let's talk about those who are, you know, in our area, which now we can count the United States and North America for that matter. Can you give us just a brief outline of Rockaway Blue, and perhaps lead us into September 11th?
Yeah, well, the book is available in all bookstores, apart from digitally on Amazon and everything too.
Okay.
But you brought up Rockaway earlier, how we did well when we were playing out there. So I always saw Rockaway as Black 47 country. And my brother, Jimmy, lives in Breezy Point. So I had a lot of connections with the area. And when I came to write the book, it's about a family, the Murphys. The father's detective sergeant, Jimmy Murphy. His wife, Maggie, is... Catholic school teacher. And his son, Brian, is a kind of a rising star from the minute he can stand. He recites Irish poetry with his mother, and he gets a scholarship to Regis, goes on to Georgetown, is up near the top of his class, and he could write his ticket anywhere, but he decides to become a cop, like his father.
Yeah.
And he shoots up past his father really quickly and becomes a lieutenant at 30. And then things start going weird for him. He seems to be always taking phone calls out on the deck. He lives in Breezy. And he has a younger brother called Kevin. And Kevin was never a rising star, but he is in the FDNY. And, you know, they go along like most families. There's ups and downs in the family. Yeah. And everything is going fine until 9/11. And as usual, Brian is at the center of things. And he saves seven people from the North Tower. But then, when everybody's running for it, he runs back upstairs, and the building falls down on top of him. The family, of course, is shattered. The mother, Maggie in particular, takes it really badly. But they're finally, after about 3 years, they're coming to terms with it a bit. When Jimmy finds out, Jimmy the father finds out that Brian was actually in the building 30 minutes before the planes hit. Mm. What was he doing there? Had he some premonition, you know, that the plane was going to hit? But he goes to his superiors in the police department, and they just say, it's, you know, leave it be, Jimmy, leave it be. You don't want to know.
Yeah.
Because you may find out some stuff about Brian that you don't know about. And do you want that going back to Maggie? She's just coming out of, you know, this grief.
Yeah.
So Jimmy is faced with this moral dilemma. Now, he had a difficult relationship with his son. They loved each other, but didn't get on that well. And so he's wondering himself, you know, what should I do, you know? But he knows he can't let it go. He has to find out what or who his son actually was. And that's the book.
All right. It's the book, again, friends. It's called Rockaway Blue. My guest, Larry Kerwin, you know, a composer, an author, a singer, a band leader, and I want to end on a personal kind of note. There was some, I don't remember the year, but I was being honored, which is peculiar in hindsight, as a Democrat. I was being honored by the Irish American Republican Club, and I know that Jeff Cleary was involved in that, and it was a nice event, and I went down to pick up whatever the hell it was. You know, it wasn't money, it was a plaque or something. And across the street, here is Larry Kerwin and Malachy McCourt and a bunch of hooples, you know, with a picket line. And you know, I was tempted to go over and shake hands with you. And then I came to my senses and said, to hell with them. You know, but it was another experience. One, as I say, that so I never knew what you were protesting into this day, and now it doesn't matter, of course.
Well, we were protesting against John McCain, of all people, whom I actually liked. And John McCain, the protest was the grannies against the Iraq War, and I was very much against the Iraq War.
All right.
So Malachy gives me a call, and he says, Kerwin, get up here. I won't give you his exact words, but he said, you're a man, we need you up here. There's only going to be you and me and the grannies. So at the minute I got up there, one of the grannies hands me a sign. I don't know what I was saying. She said, start screaming as soon as McCain comes. I actually kind of like John McCain. So as soon as we saw him, we started screaming. And McCain stopped in the middle of the road, and he thought, what the hell is going on? And he came, he walked over to us and he said, you know, I've had many people protesting against me. What are you actually protesting against? Mm. And of course, the granny started screaming at him. And
Yeah.
And he got the, I don't even know the particulars, but there's myself and Maliki, red-faced, holding the plaque.
Yeah,
so
well,
I didn't even know you were in there.
like I say, I, you know, I got some kind of a plaque anyway, and but the event or the occasion I don't remember, but I do remember seeing my two buddies across the street, particularly.
Listen, I'd totally forgotten about it.
Yeah, Larry Kerwin, friends, a friend for so many decades, and somebody who's admired greatly as an author and a playwright and a band leader and a singer, and just about you covered the gamut. And as far as we know, you have no intention of slowing down, but it's a pleasure to speak with you and to again you know, see you know, our listeners check out, you know, Rockaway Blue by Larry Kerwin, and again, published by Cornell University Press, in bookstores, on Amazon, and friends, I think you will check it out anyway. Thanks, Larry. And
thanks so much, Adrian and Anya. It's been a pleasure talking to you, man. Brings back memories.
Yes. Okay. And friends who are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, The Flannelly Show, from live from New York.